There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
At the Tudor court, there was a cast of characters who have been little consulted by historians, but who served as intimate witnesses of the lives of Henry VIII's queens. These were their ladies-in-waiting, their gentlewomen, their maids of honour. We should not mistake these for 19th-century servants. These women were high-born, even if they performed menial tasks, and many of them were educated, which means that they could write, and they did. Maria de Salinas, who served Catherine of Aragon, wrote letters describing her experience. Another of Catherine's ladies, Francisca de Caceres, may have been a spy for the Spanish state. Anne Boleyn and Anne of Cleves' ladies played a role in their downfalls, and a lady from each of their households became Henry's next wife. The power that ladies-in-waiting had as intimate informants could be used for and against each queen. This is the discovery of Dr. Nicola Clark, whose new book, The Waiting Game, the untold story of the women who served the Tudor queens, explores the limits and possibilities of the lady-in-waiting and considers what such ladies have to tell us about the hidden world of court politics. Dr. Nicky Clark, welcome to Not Just the Tudors. Or welcome back, I should say.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
We're talking about the subject of your new book, which is called The Waiting Game, and thinks about the ladies in waiting who served the Tudor queens, or at least specifically Henry VIII's queens. And you say towards the end of the book, I think it's in your acknowledgements, that this is the book that you had always wanted to write, because you'd looked at history and thought, where are the girls? So why ladies in waiting?
Well, partly because there's quite a lot of writing about the queens already. And they're great. They're fascinating. We love them. But I wanted to do something that was a bit different. Ladies-in-waiting are always there. I mean, you see them in every TV programme, don't you, as a pretty phalanx of faces behind the Queen. But you also see them in the sources, again, in the background. The Queen came there with two ladies-in-waiting. And I always used to think, OK, but who were these women? Surely they are more important than just standing around and looking pretty. I also got into this topic off the back of my first book, which was about the Howard women. Some of them were ladies-in-waiting, and in that book, I wrote a chapter about them as courtiers. And I realised while I was writing it that the context that I wanted to be able to put them into just didn't really exist as a clear piece of work that I could read. So I thought, well, all right, this is my next project. And it was while researching that it became very clear that it wouldn't only be me and other academics who would be interested in this, that perhaps quite a lot of people might find it interesting and I should write it for a broader audience. So here we are.
And I think we should probably talk about terminology before we go any further. When we're talking about ladies in waiting, there are various different ranks that we're referring to. Can you give us an idea of what those are and also the sort of numbers that we're talking?
It's a little bit how long is a piece of string, because it's not always super clearly defined all of the time. Usually there are maybe between 20 and 25 women who are in service in ordinary, is what they called it. And that meant that you had a defined, clear position. that may or may not be salaried, but you were supposed to be there, in theory, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all year round, unless you have permission to be elsewhere. So there's maybe 20 to 25 women who do that. And what they do varies quite a lot. Their role really is to do whatever the queen needs them to do. So your rank as the lady in waiting doesn't necessarily correspond super closely at this time with what you're doing. For most of the time, there's about 3 clear ranks. So you've got the ladies at the top. They tend to be the highest status women. You would then have probably the gentlewomen in the middle, who are, again, maybe the wives of knights, the daughters of nobles, middling status. And then you would have between 2 and 4 chamberers at the bottom. And they tend to be the slightly lower ranking women who do the slightly more menial tasks. Things like looking after the queen's jewels or keeping her chambers clean, things like that. As time goes on, you would also find about 6 maids of honor who are young adolescent girls, a little bit older than we tend to think they were. They're usually about 16. There are 6 of them. And for them, the court is kind of like a finishing school environment. They're there to meet people, gain a bit of social polish, hopefully make a better marriage. And they're under the supervision of the mother of the maids. So those are the ranks you normally see, at least at the beginning of this period. There is some evidence to suggest that it diversifies a little bit as time goes on. So there's a list for Catherine Howard in the 1540s that suggests that by that time you've got women of the Privy Chamber and then women of the Presence Chamber. So that level of privacy, I suppose, has potentially changed what's going on there. How that really affected things on the ground on a day-to-day way is very difficult to tell, or whether it's simply that whoever was making that list wanted to call them that. Different terms are used by different people. So it can be quite frustrating to try and keep it straight.
So in your book, you think about specific individuals. There are so many of these women, but you've chosen particular women where we have some good evidence, where you can follow them through a little bit. And the first person that I'd like us to speak about that you focus on in your book is Maria de Salinas. Who was she? And why was she in royal service?
Maria might be, you shouldn't have favourites, should you, among historical figures. But I think because we just didn't know that much about her originally, I found finding out about her the most interesting. So she's one of Catherine of Aragon's Spanish ladies-in-waiting, who comes over to England with Catherine in 1501. Maria is Castilian. She's from a city called Vitoria, which is now called Vitoria-Gasteiz, which is about 200 miles north of Madrid. She comes from a court family. So her family have been in service to Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabella of Spain and their various relations for some time. So in that sense, Maria is following a family pattern. It's probably not her choice necessarily to leave the country and go to England, but it is considered to be a good thing, probably for her, probably for her family. This is one of the roles of ladies in waiting, to almost act as mediators and peace weavers between nations in the same way that queens and queens consort do. So she goes to England. She is maybe just slightly older than Catherine of Aragon herself is, so late teens at this time. And she goes to England with Catherine and stays there. She never comes home again. But that was not her plan. Maria is so often written in literature as the kind of epitome of loyalty, epic sisterhood, because there is an enduring rumor that Catherine of Aragon dies in her arms in 1536. I would love to be able to prove that. I couldn't prove it. She was there when Catherine dies. So she is there all the way through. But earlier on, when she goes to England, actually, she's desperate to get home again. She doesn't like England at all. She says this is not a country to stop in unless necessary, which I just love.
And you know that because you have drawn on her letters, which, as you say, are unused by English-speaking historians and underused by Spanish scholars. Tell us about these and the tone and content of them, because it seems like a wonderful source to have found.
They are amazing. I came across them while trying to find out who Maria's parents were, because she's one of these women who routinely gets the wrong parents assigned to her. And because she gets different sets of parents assigned to her in different secondary sources, I thought, hang on, can I pin this down any more closely? And it was falling down rabbit holes on Google that I came across a recent PhD thesis that was actually about a man who turned out to be Maria's brother-in-law. His name is Ochoa de Landa, and he was a treasurer for the Spanish royal family. And it was through that, in a footnote, I discovered that these letters existed, tucked away among Ochoa's family papers in the Archivo General in Simancas in Spain. I think it's common, isn't it, for historians to say, oh, we found these sources. They weren't lost. They were exactly where they were supposed to be, tucked away amid these papers. It's just that nobody was really aware that they were there because it's not an obvious place to go and look. And this is one of the things with ladies-in-waiting who move countries, who go abroad with their mistress, is that they fall between these archival cracks. If she's left her country of origin, as Maria did, then she would no longer realistically appear in many sources there. But in England, she might start appearing in sources, but nobody is going to record specifically where she came from or specifically who she was in terms of her family. So trying to put those pieces together is like trying to mend a jigsaw puzzle that still has bits missing. So yes, these letters are amazing. She came to England and she wrote letters home. She wrote a lot of them to her brother-in-law, Ochoa, because by this point, both of her parents are dead or very nearly so. Her brother then is quite useless and becomes a monk. And so her brother-in-law becomes the nominal head of the family. She wants to go home. The only way she's able to do that is if they arrange a marriage for her. So she starts writing letters back. And these are probably a selection. There are maybe 20 letters in total, which is quite a lot for a woman, an early modern woman of this date, really. I don't know how many women we've got that many letters for in English scholarship, but not very many. But they are all between about 1506 and 1508, which means during the period where Catherine of Aragon was widowed in England, Prince Arthur had died, and she is stuck as a diplomatic pawn between her father, Ferdinand of Aragon, and her father-in-law, Henry VII, who are arguing about the finances and the dowry. And can we really let her marry Prince Henry when you didn't pay her dowry, et cetera, et cetera. And Catherine and her household, which included Maria, fell into poverty, and it was quite a dire, dark time for them. And we often think Catherine was exaggerating, because really the only evidence we have for this is her own letters to her father. But Maria's letters also cover these dates and suggest that things really were as bad as Catherine is saying. So she is writing home to her family saying, right, you said I should marry this guy. Tell me about him. Does he actually have any money? Does he have any position? I'll do what you want me to do, but you need to prove to me why you want me to do it. And they're so interesting because most letters from a woman at this time to family members, particularly male family members, would be quite deferential. You would expect her to be showing a lot of respect in writing to these men who hold the course of her life in the palm of their hand. And she sort of sometimes does this. And sometimes it's like she forgets. And her frustration and her anger and her natural, I guess, sharpness and intelligence really start to shine through. And for want of a better word, she's just really sassy. She at one point writes to her brother, well, you might as well be dead for all the good you've done me. Which is not what you would expect a woman in her late teens to say to her older brother, who's the head of her family. So yeah, Maria is a little bit of a force of nature. And I fell in love with her while reading these.
And as you say, much of the letters are about the goal of marrying, which is perhaps one reason why women are coming to court in the first place. And she takes some time to do that. We won't go through it all now, but I want to pick up on the fact that she is one of the few Spanish women who remain with Catherine after the coronation and after it all turns good and Catherine becomes queen, that she is then present at some of the key moments, I suppose. She's present then when Catherine has her first traumatic stillbirth. And one of the things I'm struck by in your book is both the intimacy, of course, of ladies-in-waiting, but also their perceived power. There's another example from a few years later with Maria in 1514, where we get a kind of insight into the way that it is understood that these women have extraordinary amounts of what we might call soft power, and that that has been so hidden from the dominant discourse about the Tudor period.
Yeah, absolutely it has. And sometimes it remains so hidden just by dint of the way the sources have or haven't survived that we've still only got half a story. And actually, when you start looking, sometimes all you're left with is other people's fear, which is so interesting. Other people going, oh, but she's cousin to this person. And you can almost hear that they are writing it in that tone, as though this is obviously something of massive significance that whoever's writing and their recipient understand without needing to embellish. And we're sitting there going, okay, but why? Why is that important? And then you have to try and track this historical narrative all over Europe sometimes, which is bizarre. So yes, Maria is related to some Spanish people who are not on the side of the Spanish crown. The Spanish crown goes through a period where it's almost under attack. The crown of Castile, in any case, after Isabella of Castile dies, it is supposed to go to her daughter, who is of slightly unsound mind. Her husband would like to take it, but so would her father, and they are fighting over this. Maria's family, as court servants, are caught up in this, but one of her cousins has fallen in with a guy who is bad news for Ferdinand of Aragon, and the Spanish ambassador in England knows about this, and he's writing back going, watch Maria, be careful of her. Catherine loves her. She keeps listening to her, but remember who her cousin is. And you think, oh, okay. I couldn't find out that she was actually doing anything dodgy at all. And she may not have done. But the fact that they were worried about it and that they were so concerned that this familial relationship might have bad repercussions through this woman does just show you how much power that they assumed she might be able to wield, even if in the end she chose not to.
And actually, if we go back in time very briefly to another of Catherine's ladies, Francisca Cáceres, you suggest that there is evidence from a later source, a descendant's source, writing, I don't know how many years later, that actually Cáceres was a spy. And this is an interesting woman because she's very close to Catarina, as the evidence suggests, but she also falls out with her quite spectacularly. And it's something that Catarina remembers really vividly years later. And so I wanted to ask you about this, you know, tell me more about the spying, but also what do you think in the end that Cáceres did wrong?
It's very difficult to tell. I'm not sure she really did anything wrong. I would actually controversially put the blame on Catherine of Aragon and her confessor at this point. So Catherine of Aragon, again, this is something else ladies in waiting can tell us more about, actually. They do shine a different light on some of the queens. Catherine of Aragon usually is seen as the steadfast, the faithful, the stubborn one, but the calm and reasonable one. And actually, particularly earlier on, where she's still young, that's not necessarily the case. Catherine is passionate, but it gets misdirected and she does make some bad decisions. And she also holds massive grudges, which I think we sort of forget. And one of those is against one of her women, Francisca. So Francisca had also come across in 1501 with Catherine. We don't know particularly who her family are. It's just so far not been recovered from the records. But there is a text in an archive in Spain that claims to be written by her descendants that says she was there as a spy for the Spanish crown. Francisca's very close to Catherine. So the morning after Catherine's wedding night with Prince Arthur, the next day, it is Francisca, who apparently is not smiling, is looking very solemn, and is then mocking Arthur's alleged inability to perform. And the Spanish women shut up shop for that day. Nobody else really goes in and out. So it may be that she informed the Spanish crown about that. But Francisca as well, just like Maria, does not want to stay in England in this terrible situation where they're in limbo. They don't know what's going to happen. They can't even clothe or feed themselves properly. It's not good. She also wants to get out. She also wants to get married. In 1508, a new guy comes to England to conclude the financial arrangements for Catherine's marriage with Prince Henry. This guy is an Italian. He's a banker. He's there to put up the money. He would really like to marry a lady in waiting. And that's a thing that Italian bankers seem to do in the Spanish court. They marry Spanish ladies in waiting to kind of get them into the center of power. So clearly he's thinking that he could do this here. Great. He thinks, yeah, cool. Francisca looks great. But he's put up to this by Catherine's confessor. Her confessor wants Catherine's entire loyalty. He doesn't like that she's loyal to anyone else or that anyone else has her confidence. He sees Francisca as a threat. So he encourages this marriage, thinking, great, marry her to the banker, you'll get her out of my way. He then suggests that the banker should blackmail Catherine into getting a really big dowry out of her, and that would be great. This happens. Catherine goes along with it. The Spanish ambassador's horrified. This is how we know about this, because he wrote about it in his reports back home, going, what the hell is going on here? Get the confessor out of here. He's making Catherine make terrible decisions. The confessor and Francesca then have a stand-up row in public in front of the princess. Francesca refuses to make her confession to Catherine's confessor, which is a huge snub. Catherine blows up in smoke, banishes Francesca, kicks her out of the household, says, fine, go. And for Catherine, that's that. That's end of. Francesca actually stays around in England for quite a while, for quite a number of years, it looks like. We don't see her going back to Granada really until the 1510s. So she's there a good number of years. And a later Spanish ambassador is still trying to get her back into Catherine's household and says, look, I can't figure out what's going on in here because I don't have eyes and ears. We need her back. And the way that he says, we need her back, then I'll know what's going on, does suggest that what her descendants later said about her acting as some kind of spy or agent perhaps has the ring of truth about it. She is there to keep links strong between the Spanish crown and Catherine's household in England. But even after this, Francesca's still in London. King Ferdinand of Aragon thinks, all right, well, if Catherine won't have her back, perhaps we'll put her in Princess Mary's household, or perhaps we'll put her in somewhere else in Europe. That would be helpful. Catherine absolutely refuses to give her a reference. She says she is so perilous a woman that it shall be dangerous to put her in a strange house. So what is it that's said in Pride and Prejudice? Your goodwill once lost is lost forever. That is how Catherine operates. And sometimes her ladies-in-waiting get on the wrong side of that.
Yes, there's a wonderful line in one of Catherine's letters to Fuensalida, that ambassador, in which she says, I close by wishing the coldness of your house for Francisca de Caceres' health. Which is just, it's just total spite. I think she could definitely hold a grudge. So let's skip forward again then, take us back to the 15 teens. Because one thing your book really sort of made me aware of was that at the end of 1518, as Catherine has her last pregnancy and her last child born dead, around her, she has women who are giving birth. And I was struck by the fact that to be a lady-in-waiting, you had the riskiness of your female body betraying your mistress. And one of these women is even worse, pregnant by Catherine's husband. So there's this extraordinary sort of layering of loyalty and disloyalty, even on a physical level.
Yeah, absolutely there is. And how much choice these women really have in that is definitely a question we could be asking. Henry VIII often liked to feel chosen. He didn't like to feel as though he was forcing women to have sex with him, if that makes sense. And certainly at this point, early on, 15, 16, 17, 18, there's not really any reason to think that he is forcing anybody. He's still hot at this time, so the sources would have us know. He's also not yet had a long-standing mistress. So nobody really knows how that would go in Henry's court. Will these women get anything out of this? Or will it ruin them forever? It's not yet completely clear. So Elizabeth, or Bessie Blount, is one of Catherine of Aragon's maids, we think. She catches Henry's eye somehow. They have some sort of liaison. Whether it's of incredibly short standing or whether it's of longer standing is not quite clear in the sources. But in either case, she does end up pregnant with what turns out to be his son. She doesn't seem to get a whole lot from it, and neither do her family. So that narrative of Henry really gifting things to the husbands, brothers, fathers of the women that he sleeps with, and it therefore being a route to power, that's the slightly later narrative. This early, that doesn't really seem to be the case. There's no strong evidence for that. But she does get pregnant with Henry's son. And that's not happened before either. But there is a more broadly established narrative of how this goes. I suppose Henry is not the first king to have had mistresses and illegitimate children. Catherine of Aragon also knows how this goes because she's known her dad for a long time and he does the same thing. So yeah, at some point, Bessie quietly goes away. They install her in a priory on the borders of East Anglia, and there she goes into confinement and gives birth. And she never seems to regain her place in Henry's bed after that either. Catherine is just expected to put up and shut up. It must, you would think, have been awkward for them to continue to work together, essentially, during this time. This is the kind of thing the sources just don't really tell us. Do they avoid speaking to each other? Are they in the same room? But, you know, is there gossip? Or does everybody just keep their mouths shut because there's nothing more to say? They know what the situation is and it is what it is, you know? I think it would have been interesting to observe, put it that way.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Don Wildman, and on American History Hit, my expert guests and I journey across the nation and through the years to uncover the stories that have made the United States. From first flight to first ladies, from stitching the Star-Spangled Banner to striking gold in California, to shooting for the moon with Apollo, we've got you covered. Catch new episodes of American History Hit, a podcast by History Hit, every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's have a think now about one of the other women that you follow, and that's Elizabeth Stafford, who becomes Duchess of Norfolk. And I was struck by a couple of things about her story. One is that service as a lady-in-waiting is not necessarily continuous, and that if you are in that position, you're balancing your court role with your responsibilities as a noblewoman. And the second was the extent to which her circumstances parallel the Queen's, although arguably even more extreme than Catherine's. Tell me a bit about her position.
So Elizabeth Stafford is the daughter of the Duke of Buckingham. So top draw nobility, really, couldn't get much higher. The Duke of Buckingham, unfortunately, is executed for treason in 1521. By this point, Elizabeth has married Thomas Howard, who at this point isn't especially significant, but goes on to become the third Duke of Norfolk. He is the one who is Anne Boleyn's uncle, which makes Elizabeth Stafford Anne Boleyn's aunt by marriage. He's also the one who has to be very high in the running for most disliked man in Henrician England, I think, or certainly in the Henrician court. He seems to have very few redeeming qualities. The sources do not paint him as a nice man at all. And it's very difficult not to feel sorry for Elizabeth marrying him. But initially, at least, things seem to be okay. They have 4 children who survive into adulthood, just. He is out and about in Ireland. She goes with him to Ireland at one point, which must have been a bizarre adventure. He's in the north. He's doing his soldierly thing because Thomas Howard is one of the realm's best soldiers. Elizabeth is at court and she's in service with Catherine of Aragon. And she says in the 1530s that she'd been in service for 16 years. But we know from the surviving sources, some of which are her household accounts, that they couldn't have been consecutive years. She wasn't literally at court for 16 years straight without ever leaving. Because for some of those years, accounts show that she was at various family homes in East Anglia, hosting family celebrations in her husband's absence and things like that. And that does suggest that noble women like Elizabeth, who have responsibilities elsewhere for managing estates, having children, if not bringing them up, that they are not expected to be at court 24/7. They are expected to dip in and out. And that seems to be what she does for much of her career. Where her life starts to mirror Catherine of Aragon's is when her husband takes a mistress in the late 1520s, at the same time as Henry VIII becomes interested in Anne Boleyn. Her husband's mistress is called Bess Holland. She may have worked in their household in some capacity, it's not quite clear. Elizabeth later describes Bess as the washer of my nursery, but her status shouldn't really have been low enough for that. So Elizabeth does like to exaggerate and insult Bess a lot in the letters that she writes later. So that may be what's going on. Elizabeth is not cool with the fact that her husband took a mistress, which itself is not the picture you usually get from noble women at this time. Generally speaking, the kind of sources that we have suggest that women just put up and shut up. The double standard was alive and well. What choice did they have? Elizabeth, not happy with this at all, starts kicking off, raising hell, etc. Even the Spanish ambassador reports this, so it's clearly big news at court. There are various points where family members are brought in to try and mediate between them. She absolutely refuses to calm down. Eventually, in the mid-1530s, there is some sort of last straw event. We don't know what it was. Her husband rode to East Anglia all night, apparently, from the court, locked her up in a room, took away her clothes and her jewels, which are the status symbol that goes along with being Duchess of Norfolk. So it's like he's removing her status as Duchess and therefore kind of as his wife. He then takes her to a house in a town or village called Redbourne in Hertfordshire, installs her in a much smaller household there, and leaves her, effectively under house arrest, for the rest of Henry VIII's reign. From there, she starts writing very upset letters to Thomas Cromwell, trying to get him to intervene, mediate. And that's how we know about a lot of this stuff that has gone on and that is going on for Elizabeth during that time. And it's not a stretch to see how clearly that mirrors what's going on with the king and queen. And it well may be that Elizabeth too saw this comparison and refused to knuckle under, almost in solidarity.
And those letters to Cromwell, who at first glance seems like an unusual confidant for married women in distress, but actually you make a good case for why he is so, we see in those letters that actually our sense of Thomas Howard, Duke of Norfolk, as being an unpleasant person is deeply rooted in fact, in that he is physically violent towards his wife. And there are so many instances that are told with such a level of detail that I feel, as not only as a sort of woman in solidarity, but very much as a historian thinking about these as evidence, it seems fairly clear to me that these things did happen, that he has been really pretty awful towards Elizabeth.
Absolutely. Yes, she's not sparing in the detail. And she says the same thing, almost with the same phrasing, multiple times in different letters. And whether that's because that's how she now explains this to people, you know, humans do this a lot, don't they? They figure out how they tell the story. And so they tell it the same way every time. But that's not to say that it's not true. So she says that he got his women, she says, which could only be the women of the household, so possibly the women who had been in her own service, to bind her and pinnacle her and sit on her breast until she spat blood. Or, and sometimes she says, until blood came out at my finger ends. It's just, it's really visceral. It's really unpleasant. And it's really violent. And it's almost as though he himself is not necessarily on that occasion being violent. He's ordering the violence and getting other people to do his bidding for him. And it's almost like he won't get his own hands dirty, which is a little bit of a Thomas Howard vibe elsewhere as well. He does like to order executions. He's the one who orders the execution of men, women, and children off the back of the Pilgrimage of Grace in 1537. But yeah, he is not a nice man. At one point, he suggests to Elizabeth that they should be divorced. It's very clear where he got that idea. He watched the king and he thought, aha, a solution to my problem. But the problem is that divorce in Tudor England didn't exist then as it does now. They did use the word, but it was a bit of a catch-all term. If he wanted an annulment, which is what Henry wanted from Catherine, which meant that the marriage effectively would never have occurred, and that would leave everybody free to move on and remarry, he would need to have proof as to why he was entitled to that, which would probably mean he had to prove that their bloodlines were too close in some way. That would have been a little bit difficult, I think, because it wasn't the case. And if he wanted just a separation from a church court, again, he'd have to prove that she'd been adulterous or she would have to prove that he'd been cruel or violent, which she probably could have done, but is absolutely not willing to do. And I think that's a status thing. What she wants is her status back. She doesn't necessarily want him back in her house. At one point she says, if I went back, my life would be but short. But she doesn't want to give everything up and allow herself to be painted as the one in the wrong. She wants to maintain her status. And if he wants to do things he shouldn't do, he should take the social flak for that, not her.
Now, what you just said about the woman sitting on her chest, a very visceral image you gave us. Metaphorically, we see that among some of the women who served the queens. I was really struck by this in your book, that again and again, we see women involved in the downfall of their mistresses. So the obvious example is Anne Boleyn. And both before and after she's in the Tower, we see their testimony being used against their mistress. And that is a really striking example of the power of ladies at court, but also how it didn't necessarily serve the person it was supposed to.
Absolutely. Yes, these women are having to negotiate horrendous tightropes of loyalties. And I don't think we should necessarily judge or blame them for sort of turning against their mistress. I think concept of solidarity and sisterhood didn't exist then quite in the way they do now. But also how much choice they really had is debatable. If you're a woman at court, then you're not just consulting what you want to do and what you think is right and wrong, but what does your husband think is right and wrong, and what does he want you to do? Or if not your husband, your father or your brother or some other family member or your mistress or the king. When you go in service at court, you have to take an oath of service, but that is to the queen and to the king if you're a woman. And the king's trumps the queen, so you are supposed ultimately to be loyal to the king. Ordinarily, it's not a problem, it's just a form of words, but it becomes a problem if the king and the queen's interests diverge, which of course is what happens many times through Henry's reign. At that point, as a lady in waiting, you are theoretically supposed to be loyal to the king. Women made different choices in those circumstances. So Elizabeth Stafford, who we've just been talking about, she refused to follow the rest of her marital family and support Anne Boleyn. She continued to support Catherine of Aragon. She even refused to attend Anne Boleyn's coronation. But there are other women who made a different choice. And yes, around the time of Anne's fall, there are women who either deliberately or accidentally do provide evidence against her. And then there are women who almost function as her jailers when she's in the Tower of London. But again, if the king says, you do this, you can't realistically turn around and say, yeah, no, don't fancy that, actually. She's my maid. Doesn't feel good. The king would say, oh, well, you must be complicit then. Maybe we'll put you in the Tower too. Maybe your life will be at risk.
And indeed, that is what does happen to one lady, as we'll see.
Absolutely, yeah. So I think the sense of danger must have been really palpable. But there are also some women, I think, who... it's too much to say that they function as crown spies or crown agents. That sounds very defined and very clear, and I don't think it's as clear-cut as that. But there are some women who the king seems to know he can trust to, you know, get his wives and his daughters to do what he wants them to do. Or he can trust these women to report back to him truly and not take his wife or his daughter's side. One of those is Mary, Lady Kingston, who is the wife of the Tower Constable. So she is in the Tower with Anne Boleyn, and she is reporting back everything that Anne says. And it's not that this was a secret either. Anne would have expected this to be the case. Nobody is hiding that this is happening. But what I found really striking, and I'd never joined the dots on this before, is that pretty much the minute that Anne is executed, Mary, Lady Kingston, is shuttled off to Princess Mary's household to help persuade Princess Mary to knuckle under to her father and say, yes, all right, I'm illegitimate. Fine, I will swear to the oath of supremacy. Fine, you're in charge. And she succeeds. And yet Mary still seems to trust Lady Kingston afterwards, which is astonishing. So yeah, these women are negotiating a lot of different loyalties, and the king seems to know who he can use for what purpose, if that makes sense.
And what you've said is that Mary Kingston and other women naturally as well are strategic, they are charismatic, they are able to use their tongues to persuade, And we see that very much here. And if necessary, persuade somebody to speak when actually it's against their interest to do so. And actually, it's very interesting to see that she's moved into Princess Mary's household, because whilst you note that not that many women serve both Catherine of Aragon and Anne Boleyn for obvious reasons, like the Queen's jewels, the ladies-in-waiting generally seem to have been passed from one queen to another. And I was thinking about that sort of continuity, the fact that you've got experienced women in the role. These women like Jane Parker or Jane Boleyn, Viscountess Rochford, who serves many of the queens. But there are also opportunities to become a part of the queen's household. And you think about Anne Bassett in your book in 1537 as an example of this. How, if there is this continuity of personnel, did anyone ever break in? How did you get a role at the court if that's what you wanted?
Honestly, with difficulty. And with Anne Bassett, you really see how difficult it was. Ideally, what you need are contacts who are already in the Queen's household. So you need an in with some of the women who are already there, because positions come up and then go so quickly that you need to predict almost who is potentially going to get married and leave next. So which position is going to become vacant before it even has, so you can get in there quick and make your interest known on behalf of whichever young lady it is you're trying to get into the court. And this happens a lot. So Anne Bassett's family are the Lyle family. Her mother is Honor, who is now Viscountess Lyle, and her stepfather is Arthur, Viscount Lyle, and he's the deputy of Calais. So the family are based in Calais. For that reason, they have a guy who is their London agent, who deals with all their London business for them, talks to everyone, deals with the legal stuff, whatever. So when they think, right, we need a link with court, we need a strong link so that the king sees our family in front of his face every day, they think, right, well, let's try and get the girls into the queen's household. Fab. And this is the late 1530s, and Jane Seymour is in situ as queen. And there are two sisters. The elder is Catherine, the younger is Anne. And they're trying to get both of them into the Queen's household. And John Hussey, their London agent, is driven almost mad by this quest to try and do this. He's going, right, okay, Lady Lyle, you want to speak to this person, this person, this person, and this person. Don't bother with the men. They're no good. You need the women who are there. Oh, this position. Oh, no, she's staying after her marriage. This position's cut. Oh, no, it's already gone to someone else. Damn. And it goes on like this for months. And they're trying to send gifts to the right people. They send a lot of quails to Jane Seymour herself because she's pregnant and she has a craving. And what they eventually do is send the girls over and place them in the households of two countesses who are in Jane's household, so that the countesses will take the girls with them into the Queen's presence, into her privy chamber. The Queen will see them and then she might choose one for the next vacancy. So it is all about being in the right place and being seen by the right people. It's not something that you can do by correspondence. You've got to be there. And eventually, when the Queen is eating the Lyle's quails one day, she inquires about the family. And one of the countesses says, oh, by the way, there's these two girls. And the Queen says, bring them here then. And she picks one. She picks Anne, who's the younger sister. And Anne is then rushed through, having clothes made for her, the right clothes. Initially, the Queen says, yes, you can wear your French clothes, fine, wear them out, then get the other stuff. And then changes her mind. And it all has to be done super fast because Queen Jane is about to go into confinement to give birth. And they want Anne in situ before that happens. So it's all a massive rush. She takes an oath of service. She is going to have a salary of £10 a year, which is standard for a maid of honor. The family is thrilled. Woohoo, they've achieved the impossible. So yes, it takes a lot of work, a lot of letter writing, a lot of expensive gifts, a lot of networking to even stand a chance. And these are people who do have friends at court. They're not nobodies.
And I think Elizabeth Norton was who said that that moment where you've got the two Bassett girls standing there being chosen between must have been terrible for them. I mean, it must have felt really cruel, especially for the older one, when the younger one, who's prettier than her anyway, is picked. Just the sort of pitting against each other is really deeply unpleasant. But I guess I want to sort of bring our thoughts together, because in your book, if we go on through the decades with you, we'll find ladies involved in Anne of Cleves' marriage breakdown. We find them involved in the charges against Catherine Parr, and possibly as sort of political informants for that narrative in the decades that follow. And overall, then, the picture we're getting is one of power. And I wonder how, then, having done all this wonderful work, you think that examining women who are close to the queens at this time changes our understanding of politics at the Tudor court?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it suggests, as so many narratives do, that we should be looking in the shadows. We shouldn't just look at what's obvious. I think it suggests actually that although institutions of governance remain important, in some ways, they're like the froth on the top, or the laws and the wars and things like that, and the council meetings. They're what's going on the surface. Underneath are all these interpersonal relationships that involve women as well as men, and that if we're not looking there, we're missing half the story. But even then, people who have looked there in the past have tended still to look at men. And if we don't look at the women as well, we're still missing a massive chunk of the story. I think as well, the overarching thing I really got from putting this into a narrative form was that it just became so much more dangerous to be a lady in waiting over the course of Henry's reign. And I think there is a general vibe of the king starts to pass laws, not randomly exactly, but, you know, new treason act, everything is now treason. There is an atmosphere of increasing terror, but I didn't necessarily expect to see that so clearly in the Queen's household and among her ladies in waiting. But by the end of the reign, there are councillors who are searching the lady in waiting's possessions to try and prove something against the Queen. That feels to me like it is not something that would have happened, and it's not something that we know did happen at all under Catherine of Aragon, for instance. That would have been bizarre in the early 1500s, but by 1540, standard way to try and pull down a queen. So yeah, that sense of palpable danger and distrust, and that things could turn very quickly on a knife edge, I think is a big thing that I got from studying the women at court from this angle.
Well, very revealing it is too. And I think that sense of danger is very present. And also I was struck by the freshness of your approach. There's one point early in the book where you said something that made me chuckle, which is that you're talking about jousting and you say, women did not mount horses to hit one another with sticks. And I was like, well, that there in a nutshell is the difference of a way of thinking about this from a perspective that includes women in the narrative, really, that doesn't sort of buy masculine, glorious tales of tournaments fought and actually says there's quite a bit more going on here. So I recommend to people who want that other side of the coin, the other side of the story, in fact, that's what your subtitle is, isn't it? To have a read of the book, which is called The Waiting Game, The Untold Story of the Women Who Served the Tudor Queens. Dr. Nicola Clark. Nikki, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks to you for listening to Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, and also to my researcher, Alice Smith, my producer, Rob Weinberg, and Ella Blacksall, who edited this episode. We're always eager to hear from you, so do drop us a line at notjustthetudors@historyhit.com or on X, formerly known as Twitter, at notjusttudors. And do remember to follow Not Just the Tudors wherever you get your podcasts, so you get each new episode as soon as it's released. If you'd like to know more about Henry VIII, I'm soon going to be running an online course. Just go to my website, susannalipscomb.com, and choose Courses and put your name on the waitlist, so you're the first to hear about its launch.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
History is full of extraordinary people, the Tudors being just a handful. In my latest film on History Hit, we meet Bess of Hardwick and go inside the incredible house that she built, a house that defines the elegance and grandeur of the Elizabethan age, a house fit for a woman who climbed to the top of the Tudor social ladder. To find out more about the life of Bess and many more fascinating figures from the past, sign up via the link in the description with the code TUDORS for an exclusive discount.